Hey guys, I'm Nikhil, and this is Nick.
Hello.
And today we're going to continue our podcast, one that we started last week.
So welcome back.
I guess Nick ended up finding a cool follow-up article to our conversation about caffeine last week.
I did. I saw this today on Ars Technica. The title is, Caffeine Helps You Nail Down Memories If Used After the Study Session. So the idea is that when you take in a bunch of information, your mind basically then goes and sorts through it and processes it offline. Instead of just inputting it all and figuring out what's going on, it takes a little while for it to make all the associations. So the study here that they did that was published in Nature, that they did at Johns Hopkins and UC Irvine, was they gave their study participants, they gave them caffeine after they had them do a memorization exercise, as opposed to before, which is what most people traditionally do. And then the next day they quizzed them to try and see if that had improved their recall. And what it did was it improved their ability to detect false associations. So when looking at, they had them memorize a series of images, and then the next day they would show them the images and see if that's what they studied. And so most people, if they showed them something similar, they would just associate, say, yeah, I studied that last night. But the people who had the caffeine after the study session were able to say, well, that's not quite right. So they were able to detect what they called the lures. And that shows that they had a deeper understanding and a better association with these types of objects.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, and so, of course, the article ends, it says, that makes a stronger case for that espresso after a late night study session, which made me think, yes, but if the half-life of caffeine is 6 to 8 hours, then you should probably not be doing that.
Or you should study early in the morning, so that way you can still get some sleep at night.
Now, there's another idea. That's clever. So anyways, a quick little follow-up. You can see that article again is on Ars Technica, and then the article itself is in Nature.
But it was image data that they were recalling, not...
I think it was specifically image data. I didn't get a chance to read the whole paper. But that was just what was summarized in the article itself.
Interesting paper. But mm-hmm. Again, me being a cynic, I constantly just lean towards thinking that the paper you just mentioned is riddled with biases, some kind of bias here or there. So
I'm sure it is, but unlike you, I don't need an excuse in order to consume more caffeine. So that's fine with me. So I actually thought this would be one, it's a simple experiment to try and...
Excuse me.
To try yourself and see if that actually makes any sort of a difference. But
okay.
Anyway, so a quick follow up from last week. Thought that'd be fun.
Cool.
All right. So let's move on. Sorry about this. Oh gosh. Let's move on to the next topic I had here was talking about data science or informatics in general. So last week we made a few comments about being data scientists or informaticians, but we didn't really talk about really what that means or how that's different from like CS or statistics or something like that, or really why we got into informatics. So Nikhil, if you had to give a 30-second explanation of what informatics is, what would you say?
A 30-second explanation. Okay. Well, if I had to define it, you know, I think the biggest difference between informatics and computer science is that in informatics, we also consider the social side of things. We take design into account. We take how our design is going to be used by people.
What do you mean by design?
I mean, like, if we just make a computer program and it works, that's great. But we kind of ask the question, is it actually fulfilling the purpose that it's meant to fulfill? Like, or did we make what we think we made? And how much are customers using it? What do they like about it? What don't they like about it? And we kind of tie that all back together into what we do. Whereas I think computer science is much more focused on the actual implementation of things. You know, they want the code to be beautiful and perfect, and they want it to be fast. Whereas we're kind of thinking, well, fast is cool, but it might not be exactly what we need. We want, you know, kind of the 10,000-foot view, the whole package. And that's, I think, the biggest difference between computer science and informatics.
Yeah, I think that's a good explanation. For me, it seems that informatics is kind of in general oriented around solving specific problems, whereas CS can definitely be in that mindset as well. But CS also is a very strong theoretical or abstract component where an acceptable solution may be proposing an answer towards a problem that doesn't exist yet, or coming up with a new theory for better explaining something that may or may not have practical implications. Whereas I think with informatics, we're pushed, especially here, more towards solving real problems and identifying issues that need to be corrected. So I think it's much more problem and application driven than CS, which can be more theoretical.
Right.
Which is, I think, is a strength. So what drew you to informatics in general, and maybe what brought you to UW?
Well, UW is definitely a impactful school, and that's sort of my my motto, is try to be as impactful as possible. Like, you know, the whole make a dent in the universe thing. I like that, and I think it's important for us as human beings to give back to the community, to make our mark in history in some way or another. And oftentimes, although people might not get recognition for it, which is okay, a lot of scientists and academics contribute heavily to human progress. So I wanted to be a part of that.
Very cool. Do you always have an interest in informatics, or is that something that kind of emerged later in your career?
Well, I wanted to be a zoologist. I wanted to be a big cat trainer. Yeah, I wanted to train like tigers and lions and
bears.
Not bears. They aren't cats, but
lions.
But
tigers,
that was the kind of like where I started. But my father was a computer scientist. Is a computer scientist. And I started to learn how to program when I was pretty young. I'd say, 10 or 11. I kind of started to go through his C books, and then C was kind of heavy for me, so I picked up HTML and started to dabble in JavaScript, which I still, to this day, do not know. I keep, starting JavaScript, and then I just somehow put it down and solve my problem and move on, but something I need to work on. But aside from that, I started out in biology, and then I had computer science-y skills, so when I got to college, I started to talk to professors about internships, and a lot of them were biologists and computer scientists working together, so I kind of just started to fit that niche, you know? I kind of had both skill sets, and I started to work in that little area, and that ended up becoming bioinformatics, or I was pulled into the world of bioinformatics in that way, and that's kind of how I got started. How about you?
Yeah, similar type stories. So growing up, my dad is an accountant. So we didn't have a ton of access to computers and things like that. I started reading programming books when I was younger, digging around, taking apart computers. I was always much more interested in hardware. I really didn't get into programming until late in college. I was really a hardware guy. That was my thing. And so I started an undergrad in electrical engineering. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, depending on the month, I either wanted to be I actually originally wanted to be an astronaut growing up. That's what I wanted
me too,
to be.
Man.
Yeah.
I even applied.
Yeah. Really? You applied to NASA?
I applied to NASA and I got rejected.
Yeah. that makes sense. That's cool. I didn't know. I think, what is it, what's that movie where they're talking about, they say all boys want to be either astronomers or astronauts? Is that Jurassic Park?
I don't know. I have no idea, but that's cool.
Yeah. And so they talk about the line was that the difference is like the astronomers get to look at all of the universe and explore everything and see all this different stuff, but they never get to go into space.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of, and I guess in that sense, it was kind of the demarcation between the more adventurous and the more placated, I guess. I don't know how to say that in a way that doesn't sound super condescending. I'm sure it'll come to me later. But anyways, yeah, so I wanted to be an astronaut, went to Purdue for electrical engineering, and was interested in hardware. Was interested actually in informatics, but I didn't know what that was. I was really interested in integrated information systems and things like that. But I always consider that just to be a hardware problem. Always interested in medicine and biology. Switched into medical science later on during my in my career, because I started getting interested in the medical devices and saw that most of the people in the field were engineers with a little bit of biology background. So I figured, well, why don't I be a biologist or a physician with a little bit of an engineering background? And then, you know, just kind of stumbled my way into informatics. Came to UW because I like Seattle. I like the program. It's strong integration with medicine. And it was not Indiana, so I was happy to get out.
It's beyond strong integration. Like, it's actually in the med school.
It is in the med school, which is a really unique distinction in a lot of other places. And especially being, I was talking with our department chair, the distinction here is that UW Medicine and University of Washington are fully integrated. They are the same. They are the same entity. And you don't find that at a lot of other places. I remember I was interviewing at UC San Diego, and they work closely with the medical center, but those are two operationally separate entities.
Oh, for sure.
So here, I mean, you have that to get permission or to do something kind of interesting or unique can be as simple as walking down the hall, or some of the new faculty that they're hiring in our department are going to be, you know, C-level executives within UW Medicine.
Right.
And so you have that ability to do all sorts of interesting and exciting things. A lot of the barriers to entry are kind of dropped, but
definitely a plus.
Yeah. So that's kind of cool. It's interesting. I love hearing about how people get to where they are. And especially in technology. I was reading an article the other day on Hypercritical, John Syracuse's blog, talking about kind of some of the common stories that nerds have and how they got in, how they earned the term nerd and got to where they were. And, you know, usually it starts with they're just interested and they start digging around and they're passionate about something, and maybe they don't stick with that, but then they flip to the next patent. They like go all the way in on certain things and get really excited about it.
I still resent that term.
Nerd?
Nerd. I still feel uncomfortable being called a nerd.
Do you have a preferred nomenclature?
No. I just don't like being called a nerd or a geek. I don't know. It kind of just like, I'm thinking back to high school and stuff. It's always been, in my mind, kind of a negative thing. And people have tended, you know, they wear like a badge of honor nowadays. But I don't know. It still kind of just rubs me the wrong way. It feels like, I mean, historically, I think the term has been used to refer to people who are not just smart, but kind of lack social skills.
Yes,
or they're
definitely
sort of incapable in some way, in some area of their life. And I kind of feel like I'm very well balanced, you know, if I may say so myself. So I'll
reserve judgment on that.
Yeah. but yeah, because in that way, I feel like it's kind of a misnomer to call me a nerd. But
yeah, I used to say in high school, I used to describe myself as a geek, right? Because nerds had like poor social skills or whatever, and geeks were just cool and smart and interesting. I don't know, something like that. But, you know, now it is worn as a badge of honor. You have nerd culture and nerdisty and all this stuff. And it's very, at least in my mind, part of me gets kind of wrangled up. It's like, it's a very pop culture kind of, I remember reading it. I think it was an interview with some actor or something like that, who was kind of the definition or the physical definition of like a jock or something like that. And really successful and all this stuff. And he was like, oh, I'm a total nerd, right? Because he watched, like, The Big Bang Theory or something like that.
Right.
And I was like, you know, part of me goes, oh, come on, that's not real. Like, people don't quite realize. And one of the things that bothers me about The Big Bang Theory is that it portrays this as a really funny, quirky kind of thing. But you and I both know that being a real nerd involves a lot of things that people find kind of frustrating, right? Like, it's not just, oh, funny and quirky that they like to play around with computers. It's like,
being compelled to stay up late at night and code when you want to go to bed, but you just can't pull yourself into
your
bed.
Yes, exactly. Or then people, so they like interact with me sometimes. They'll just like assume that I'm like a character in the Big Bang Theory.
Exactly.
And
terrible.
Right.
Terrible,
and well, terrible. And so then all of a sudden there's like this, you know, a couple weeks into whatever, there's sort of this realization. They're like, oh my gosh, you're like this all the time. So. You know, there's a lot more that goes into it, and you know, I wear my nerd badge proudly, especially being a little bit more well adjusted than some people. It kind of boggles their minds sometimes,
mm-hmm.
which I like.
So we talked about how informatics is different from computer science, but how do you think it's different from statistics?
From statistics,
yeah, that's kind of a more, you know, interesting question, I think.
Well, I think it continues on the theme that you were speaking of earlier, where informatics is a little bit broader. So informatics is systematic solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas a statistician might look at a problem and look at it and try to say, okay, well, we're going to figure out the correlation or the regression between these objects or whatever, or try and explain some causality or something. And informatics goes beyond that to looking at how did we gather the data. A statistician might say, well, this data is biased or wasn't gathered correctly. Where an informatician would look on the front end of saying, how do we actually gather the data? How do we improve the quality of what we're getting? And then what do we do with it once we have this answer? So statistics is a really great tool in order to identify a problem or identify a little bit of solution, but it doesn't go far enough rarely does it go far enough into implementing it.
Right.
So you may have a really great idea, but how that gets worked out into the everyday life is oftentimes not very simple. And I think informatics is especially focused around that type of response.
That's a very interesting way to put it. I like that. I've kind of been thinking that over the past few years, a lot of people who I would consider computer scientists have been rebranding themselves as data scientists.
Yeah.
And that's kind of bugged me a bit because sort of being in informatics, I've seen that whenever you hire a computer scientist to do informatics work, they kind of tend to ignore not just the social aspect of it, but when they get their data, they're very focused on the code or the implementation and the kind of loose scope of what they're actually looking at. Yeah. So, you know, you might give them a data set, they might give you statistical results, but they won't know exactly what that means or what the confounders are, or the precision variables are, the mediators are, or, you know, any of that stuff. And to them, they kind of gloss over it. And I think that's kind of a shame. And a lot of them would be a lot more valuable to their teams and to their companies if they just picked up those skills by taking, not even taking a class, maybe just going through a stats book and learning a lot of that material.
Yeah, I think, so part of my answer is fueled by where I would say that I apply these different disciplines in my everyday work or my problem solving. Where do I find myself, you know, searching stats up, you know, stackexchange.com, and where am I going through Stack Overflow? And so in my mind, or the way that I operate, is that statistics applies as the tools of the methodology that I use to approach a problem, or the theoretical foundation for it. And CS is largely oriented around the tools or the framework in which I arrive at the answer, where I pull it out of the ether.
Mm-hmm.
And then informatics kind of is the holistic approach to that, plus the other things that you've been mentioning as well.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of overlap, and you know, it's interesting because people are always defending their turf, right? Well, statisticians are always saying, "Oh, we're just overlooked this, you know, it's just an afterthought or whatever." And CS people are kind of like, "Hey, we can talk to people,"
mm-hmm.
and so you know, you get these little turf wars because there are a lot of overlaps and. There are distinct differences, and people can approach, and the people who I think kind of, especially at this stage, they self-select into into where they really to where they want to go. So they're oriented. The where the people line fall is kind of more of their orientation of what part of the problem solving chain or what part of the solution do they want to be engaged with.
It's a shame it has to be that way, though. I mean, thinking back, whenever I'd interview anybody, like if I was going to interview somebody for one of my teams, it'd be like, if we got a statistician, they'd kind of be weak in the coding area, so they wouldn't be able to wrangle data as well as a computer scientist. Whereas on the other side, you have a computer scientist, you can wrangle data like no other, but they just don't quite know what they're looking at. So there, you know, there's always there's definitely a balance to be struck. And I think that if people weren't so caught up with labels, like I'm a computer scientist who can do this, or I'm a statistician who can do that, and they just kind of looked for a skill set and did what they needed to do to get the job done, we wouldn't be arguing or fighting as much as we actually are.
Now, that's an interesting thought. Do you think that the balance should come at an individual level or at the team level? So there's like, what is it, Thoreau's myth of the jack of all trade, where there's no such thing and it's just a sacrifice, or even like Adam Smith's specialization of skills. Mm-hmm. So should that come at the individual level, or is that more of when you're building a team or orienting an organization that you should go for that striking of a balance?
I would say, I think right now, companies and schools, and whenever you make a team, they always try to make the team interdisciplinary, because they know that people don't have that balance. So they're going to hire a computer scientist, hire a statistician, hire a manager, a project manager, so on and so forth. But I've kind of always been like this one-man team, or I try to be a one-man show. I, for some reason, just enjoy doing that. Call it narcissism. I don't know. But so I like to have a balance, but at the same time, I do feel like in certain situations, I don't have enough computer science skill, or I don't have enough statistics skill. That's when I go to Stack Exchange or Stack Overflow and I find answers, or I ask questions and find answers. I think in general, people should do what interests them and find a balance for themselves. And when they have a balance for themselves, we won't really need to have these interdisciplinary teams like we do right now. It's kind of a weird sort of opposing point of view, like a contrarian point of view, but I kind of wonder what the world would look like if we operated in that way.
Interesting. I think that in my mind, I think that there's some truth that, so I tend to be more of an individual type worker as well. And part of my inclination is that I really enjoy going very broad on a topic or a problem, and less like digging all the way down to the nuts and bolts of a theory or system. But I don't know if that's really sustainable in the long run, because there are times when I'm confronted with the fact that I just don't know enough statistics, or I'm not deep enough. And you talk about learning JavaScript. So I quote unquote learned JavaScript the other month. I went through Code Academy, awesome place, to very helpful. Right. But I am not a JavaScript expert, and probably never really will be, because my time is spent other places. So there are situations in which I just don't have the expertise. And by going wide, I'm sacrificing. I'm making a conscious choice to optimize for certain characteristics, which is oftentimes out of whack at other ones.
Right.
So I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I'm curious as to how that really works out in real life.
Well, that's because I think you have access to experts. Like, if you wanted to find a JavaScript expert, it's just a matter of walking down to the CS building and being like, hey, who knows JavaScript here? And who knows it better than me? Almost everyone's going to raise their hand.
Everyone,
right? So it's one of those situations where we have access, whereas if you're a company or a startup, you might not have that access. And everybody has to play multiple roles. And more often than not, I would say the role that I play most for my own lab or for my own research, or whenever I work for a company as a contractor or an employee, I feel like I'm playing the role of a manager. Like, I'm always managing something. I'm managing my project or my product or my idea. And it ends up being that I might not need to know every little skill to the point where I'm a complete expert, but I need to know it just enough to get the job done. And a lot of times, focusing on getting things done is more important than really having a solid handle on the skills that you need to get there, because you can always contract or get somebody else to help you.
So your issue is built around resource constraints, basically.
A little bit. It's kind of, I don't think I'm explaining it very well, but for the most part, I do agree with your idea that we have limited resources and they need to make the best of the resources that we have access to. And we just tend to be managers in that way.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. I think I get what you're saying. Yeah, that's interesting. All right. Can we talk about the big news right now, or at least theoretically the big news?
Please.
Net neutrality.
Okay.
Have you been following this?
I've been under a rock.
Oh my gosh.
Please fill me in.
Okay, so you're familiar with the concept of net neutrality, right?
You know what? Go ahead and fill me in there too.
So
let's start from scratch.
All right, starting from the beginning. So this is my at least interpretation of it. So the idea of net neutrality is that internet providers, ISPs like Comcast, Google, Verizon, net neutrality takes a standpoint that they, with the open internet, that we can't impede information. So they should have an obligation to provide access to anyone who's paying, who's any of their customers. They don't have the right to reduce speed or ban content, block stuff, do anything like that. That it's just basically an open highway and anybody gets to drive on it.
Sure.
So the arguments from that are primarily that it's unfair to the ISPs to be able to not manage their own networks according to the way that they want, the way that they see fit. Especially since you're talking about the rise of these content producers like Amazon or Netflix. Netflix is the big one that everyone talks about. Mm-hmm. Now these are putting huge surges and strains on their infrastructure, and basically these guys are getting off, for free. So they want the ability to be able to class content and be able to negotiate specific agreements with individual endpoint providers. Right now, everybody just pays like a flat per megabyte or gigabyte cost or whatever it is. So part of the issue, one of the reasons why this is such a big deal is that in general, especially with the issue of Comcast, because they own NBC, Universal, they now are both the producer of content and a provider of content. So the argument that's advanced is that they think that Comcast is going to basically hamper other people's services in order to drive people towards theirs. So there was a little bit of an issue with the data caps, with Comcast data caps, because if you used like the Xfinity app mm-hmm. to do streaming or things like that, it didn't count against your bandwidth caps. And so that was a big issue. There was also quote unquote blocked access to Netflix for a while because they couldn't get a peering agreement sorted out. And it was partially predicated on this issue as well. So anyway, so the FCC put up an open internet guideline that basically said that if, a couple things. One was a transparency. They had to report how they manage their networks and stuff. One was anti-discrimination. One was anti-blocking. So they couldn't block content and they couldn't class and do speed degradation and stuff like that. And so Verizon filed suit in the appeals court of D.C. and the ruling came down in their favor yesterday. So now the internets are all up in arms because the popular opinion is that basically they said, nope, you can do it. That basically the opinion is that the FCC said, nah, you can do whatever you want. You can charge whatever and do double-ended charging and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't what they said. Actually, if you read the opinion, which is 80 pages of administrative law, which is the worst possible kind of law that you can get to, it's awful. Basically, what they said was that the argument came down to whether or not internet providers qualified as common carriers, like phone companies or public or goods transportation companies. Basically, common carrier says you can't discriminate against what people are carrying. If it's legal for you to carry it, you have to carry it, barring like just standard administrators. And you can't discriminate against different classes of carriage. So the FCC basically put out these rules, the argument was that they were per se making internet providers common carriers, which they can't do. It's against their statutory ability.
Okay.
And so that's what the court ruled. The court ruled said that you can't, that bandwidth for internet providers cannot be subject to common carrier requirements, and these rules effectively make them common carriers. So you can't do it. They threw it out. So in reality, it didn't do nearly as much harm as what a lot of people are kind of making it out to be. But it does bring up some really interesting policy questions, mainly revolving around what is the internet? Is it a public utility like water or power? Is it a public good like food or healthcare? Or is it just another competitive market or business like insurance or e-commerce, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And so the arguments kind of go both ways, which probably the majority of opinion being for an open internet policy.
Mm-hmm.
So what the court did not say was that open internet is illegal or unfeasible. So what they just said was that the FCC can't, as the rules are written, cannot enforce this. So in effect, I actually think that it was a good opinion. It was a strong opinion because it very much came to the FCC, took the FCC and said, you wrote the law, wrote these rules, you wrote the statute, you have to enforce it. You can't just say, well, actually, we're going to enforce these rules because we want to or because we think we have the authority to. So in reality, it really stopped that in its tracks and reasserted the fact that if you have a rule that's written and you can't exceed its scope just because you're the government or whatever.
Right.
So that was really good. But basically what they said was Congress can pass legislation to do the open internet, and actually the FCC itself can classify and say that internet providers are subject to common carrier rules. They have the authority. Well, supposedly they have the authority to do that. The opinion itself made it a little bit less clear, but the summaries seemed to say that they could basically just reclassify if they wanted.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That was deep. A lot of stuff there.
There's a lot of stuff. It's very, very, parts of it are very, very complicated. The open carrier stuff is very complicated. But basically what it comes down to is a policy question over what is the internet.
I think that question about whether or not the internet is a utility or whether or not it's a consumer good was pretty interesting. I'm kind of leaning towards it being more of a utility just off my gut, but I think I might need to really sit down and read more about this to make a good opinion.
Yeah. It's a confusing issue. So a part of me, like I said, I join you in concurring in part and dissenting in part.
Right.
To read from the opinion. I agree with you in a part that I think that it feels like the internet should be a public utility. The question is, what does that entail? Are we really happy with the way that our utilities are run? Do we think that that's really an effective metric?
Oh no.
Or does it follow the same principles? So for it to be classified as a utility, or at least to be thought of as a utility, does it follow both supply, the same principles of supply and demand as water and power?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, so off the bat, I'm thinking of Comcast or any kind of cable company, and how annoying it is to work with them, because they kind of, you know, there was a whole South Park episode about how cable companies can do whatever they want.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we can't do a thing about it. So it would really suck if the same thing happened to the internet. But, you know, realistically speaking, like, they are already providing internet to us.
Yep.
So it's not like it's that different. Like, if cable is a utility, then at this point the internet is too.
Yep.
Is it like water or power? I don't know about that. But, you know, it kind of follows. Maybe it's like in the middle somewhere. You know how you have consumer utilities? I would consider cable a consumer utility.
Mm-hmm.
It might fall under that category.
What else would you define as a consumer utility? And how would that be different from a public utility?
Well, cell phones.
Okay.
I think, you know, telephones at one point were... I don't know. I mean, I guess it could be considered a public utility, but it's something that you don't need to have. I think you need to have water. You need to have power in order to live life. But
yeah.
you don't absolutely need to have a telephone. So in a way, that's sort of consumer.
Yeah.
It's not like a basic requirement of life. So in that same way, I think cable and the internet fall into that same category where we, you know, we buy it. We scale it up and scale it down as we please. So maybe it should be modeled more after the cell phone plans or maybe cable plans.
Yeah.
Like, I'm thinking of it in that perspective.
Well, actually, that's exactly what the standpoint that the opinion that the court took.
Okay.
Was they looked at a couple of cases. One was Cellco, which was about whether these mobile carriers could do data caps, basically, or data roaming charges, right? Because the court has split data from phone and communications. Those are two different things now. And so they said that basically they could do roaming charges because there was flexibility in the market that they could switch carriers if they wanted, and it wasn't an undue infringement of bargaining of negotiating power, and it was like they could manage their data better. It's a complicated issue. Where it comes down to me is physicality. And the way that they've done phone providers is that, like, AT&T could provide services, run its own private network, quote unquote. Because that was their argument back in the day, was that this is our own private network for the use of our customers, et cetera, et cetera. But when it was ruled as a utility with the common carrier stuff, it was said that, well, that's fine, but you can't block other providers from using your lines because your lines are basically like a public good,
right?
Public utility. So in my sense, from my perspective, that makes sense. And in fact, there's an argument for that. And in fact, that's how we have it now with DSL, right? I don't know who owns the lines to my house. But I can do, you know, in some places I can do Verizon, in some places I can do AT&T, you know, internet,
CenturyLink, Google
whatever.
Fiber.
Google built out their own network though. And that's part of the issue, is that you do have a physicality constraint in that it's really infeasible to run for every carrier to run fiber or copper wires everywhere.
Well, you know, and it's so weird because it's kind of like we pick and choose capitalism in that way. I mean, how can a ISP say, well, we're getting shafted, you know, because we need to provide a service and we can't quite, you know, Amazon is kind of, you know, scaling up their stuff and we're taking the hit.
Yeah.
And they're kind of whining about that. But at the same time, if they really were truly capitalist, they'd sort of find a way to take that hit gracefully and then reallocate the resources maybe towards copper wires or what we were talking about with Google Fiber.
Yeah.
So that way they can compete.
Well, that's their argument, is that they should be allowed to respond to market pressure and to charge what they – and negotiate contracts. And that's basically what they're saying, is that you can't abridge our ability to conduct business.
Hmm.
And this is part of our network management. This is part of our cost. Now, the issue of – and that's a separate issue from whether or not companies should do two-way charging for both charging both the consumer and the provider,
mm-hmm.
is a separate argument from whether or not these companies should be allowed to conduct business in their own way, or what the level of regulation should be.
Right.
Because we as consumers can very much say, hey, don't charge me anymore. I don't want anyone to see my fees increased. But that, and we have the right to do that. The question is, do we have the right to tell Comcast what to charge on their for their internet?
Well,
or what they can't charge.
We can vote with our dollar, can't we?
Yes. And so part of the issue is the competitiveness, that there aren't really all that many options. That in effect, we have a duopoly or a monopoly, which we enforce those monopolies in order to build out. A lot of states in Indiana, they did this. They gave Comcast a legally enforced monopoly
mm-hmm.
on the grounds that they had to provide anybody who requested service or any like small, I think it was any person, they had to provide internet to.
Right.
So we gave the monopoly status with the grounds that they had to bite the infrastructure charges,
mm-hmm.
which I think was probably the right move at the time, because otherwise nobody was going to provide to these small little towns and stuff like that.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know if we have that same case now anymore. But again, it comes back to a physicality argument of the copper. Maybe we can't run copper lines or fiber lines everywhere. It's just unfeasible. It's something I saw, to run fiber basically everywhere in the U.S. is like $3 trillion or $6 trillion or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
How interesting that ends up being our, isn't that our deficit?
I don't remember. It's expensive, right? So it's expensive to do that. But beyond the physicality of it, one internet provider does not inherently block another internet provider from using those lines, especially on a fiber line. You have this just massive amount of bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a separate issue. And I think traditionally they've regulated the telcos as being the physical network, the backbone. They've split them up into backbone, services, and basic communication. So enhanced services, basic services, and then backbone, I think, or however the opinion marks it out. And so I think that is a model that we can use going forward of saying that Verizon and AT&T and Comcast, you guys, you can't block anybody from connecting to your network. But you can charge... So we splitting up the backbone of saying that this is that physically connecting into your exchanges or whatever, you can't block people from doing that. But you have the right to people using your systems and your switching points and this kind of stuff for negotiating contracts and rates like that. And I'm not explaining it very well, but basically severing those things together, of recognizing the fact that there's a physical limit to the number of lines we can run, but there is a very minimal limit to what we can run down those lines.
Right.
And they've done the same, they've done a really similar thing with railroads. Actually, railroads are a similar, I think it's similar pricing structure. So.
Right.
But this isn't necessarily a bridge consumer rights and choices. You still have the ability to, with the transparency rules, you have to disclose what they're doing. And there's room in there for bringing up unfair trade practices or enforcing antitrust litigation. If you can say that Comcast or Verizon are colluding to set prices, you can bring action against that. You can bring action against them. Or if Comcast is, you know, too monopolistic, where now they control everything and they're just pricing everybody else out. So in reality, like Netflix can't afford the bandwidth charges. Oh, we're going to charge you a dollar a megabyte. It's like, and then, but our services are going to be free. I think there's grounds still for action in that.
And sort of looking at the opposite end, if we considered, internet a public utility like water or power, and it was government run, how would that be different? We'd be basically paying into the internet.
Yeah.
And it would be cheap, I figure. But would the quality be up to par? I mean, what if the government chooses to, actually, in a way, it shouldn't. I mean, if we just go with the best plan we can get, let's just say we go with T1, T3 or something for all of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Wi-Fi hotspots, the city of Seattle Wi-Fi hotspots mm-hmm. everywhere. and it's just a completely open network, one, it's going to be pretty insecure. So most folks might feel uneasy using it in the first place.
Yep.
And two, it might be, I don't know, would it be cheaper? I think if everybody was paying into it, you know, on the scale of all of Seattle, it might not be as expensive as we expect it to be.
I don't know. It'd be, that's an interesting question. Part of me says there's very few government-run services that are as cheap as they ought to be,
mm-hmm.
especially since there's you either don't get really good price or you don't get good service, because if you're competing on – the government doesn't have to compete on prices because they don't have to make a profit. They can write everything as off.
Yep.
So there's that. And then when you're looking at the issues of service, if you're not, there's very little, if you're monopoly, basically you have little incentive to innovate and improve. So look at our power generation capability in the U.S. And that's a private public kind of thing. But I mean, our electric grid is not really anything to be excited or super happy with. And in fact, it's fast approaching capacity and we can't like build more and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting. A few years ago, we were just up in arms. We were still running stuff over copper lines. That was like the infrastructure of the past, and we needed to build out. We needed to just plop down and put fiber everywhere. And I think that argument is still pretty valid. And that's the argument that Verizon's advancing, of saying this stuff is really, really, really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I think the argument now is that we're getting neither good price nor good service. You know, the U.S. is like in 10th or 11th place in terms of access and quality for high-speed internet. So,
yeah.
So apparently something isn't really working. So I don't necessarily know. I don't necessarily know what the best answer is, but I don't think we have a very good or very competitive market. And the idea of using the open internet to do that is not focused on how we get data to the home. It's focused on the data that we can get into the home, which is a valid concern, but it does nothing to address the immediate issue right now of it's ridiculous that I only get 40 megabits over my DSL. And I had to buy a special modem from CenturyLink in order to do that.
Oh, wow. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking of when I first moved to Seattle, I went literally a month without internet at home.
What?
Yeah.
How does one do that?
I know, right? It's very, very interesting. So I use internet on campus. So I wasn't completely disconnected, but when I went home, I couldn't check my email. I couldn't use Twitter. I couldn't use any kind of social media. I couldn't use YouTube. I couldn't surf. I couldn't, if I had a question, I had to like do it the old fashioned way and like call somebody and be like, hey, you know about this? Hey, you know, call the operator.
1993?
Like,
what the heck?
I know. It was pretty crazy. And it was, my lifestyle was definitely different for that month. Like I was, instead of going on the computer at night, I'd be reading books and I wouldn't be watching TV. And I'd be going out to, you know, different bars and clubs and just, you know, different nights. Like they had a code night at one bar.
Wow.
Where a bunch of Ruby on Rails guys got together and just talked about coding and the
only in Seattle.
I know, but it was awesome. Yeah. Like I got out there, I got to meet lots of people. It was very, very different. And it's, in a way, I'm realizing now that I've kind of carried that on. I don't use the internet that much at home anyway. Like I only check my email before I go to bed, not constantly. And yes, I have a smartphone and it's constantly buzzing and ringing at me, but I don't always check it. I kind of just like, I've mentally been able to trick myself into putting it away and not letting it bother me.
Yeah, that's really good. And, you know, I think that when you look at this as a whole, there are two separate issues here. One is the internet as entertainment, where YouTube, Facebook, that kind of, you know, where we use it for services that we find that we don't necessarily need anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm on vacation. When I travel, I try not to take my computer unless I'm traveling for like to a conference or something. If it's personal travel, I try not to take my computer with me, and I just, you know, I read books and things like that. And it's kind of awesome. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the internet that is valuable and helps people So there's the internet of being able to do either even telecommunication, like Skyping with family members who are like far away,
Right.
or being able to send MRIs to X-rays to radiologists and on call on the other side of the world. Those kinds of things matter, and it is important that we have open internet in order to we have an internet that enables us to do that kind of stuff and facilitates those types of things, that we're continuously pushing it forward. Because when I remember when I first got broadband or whatever, and it was or I got Verizon Fios at 5 megabits. I was like, 5 megabits, that's amazing. Now I've got 40, and I had 80 in my apartment for a little bit, and it's like I have no idea what I would fill.
What do you even need 80 megabits
But
for?
isn't that the question, right? What do we need this for now? And there's a lot of arguments for like gigabit fiber. What on earth are we going to do with that? But we fill to capacity. We'll find uses, and some of them will be silly and
Isn't that
kind of
Parkinson's law?
interesting. But what?
Parkinson's law?
Is that Parkinson's
I
law?
think it is.
Okay.
Don't quote me on that, but I think Parkinson's law states that work will expand to fit the time
Okay, yeah, I know
that
what you're
has been
talking about.
allotted. So
Yeah. Yeah, so
definitely
something
applies.
like that too. So, the question on how do we, it's not just how do we generate more content and new tools, because I think that will continue. I mean, that it's hard to slow that down. The arguments for or against net neutrality are focused on a very, very small, very, very small edge cases. They seem to think that we can bring the wheels of innovation. I think they use the phrase wheels of innovation to a halt by charging people more money.
Goody.
And maybe we'll slow it down, but in my opinion, maybe that just means less cat videos on YouTube.
Right.
That was actually cited in the opinion, cat videos. Videos of
Really?
cats,
Of
yes.
course.
The other awesome line in the opinion was, even federal agencies are entitled to a little bit of pride.
I wonder how much of an economic impact these cat videos have. If a cat video is on YouTube and ads are served on that page,
Yeah.
I wonder how much money a cat video actually makes. Who knows? Maybe our economy is just being run by cats.
Maybe it's run by cats. Not even by cats, just of cats, in regards to cats. That's ridiculous.
Man.
Yeah. All right. What do you want to talk about next?
When I was went back home to see my folks, I left my gaming computer with my dad, and he wanted to swap out the video card with a different video card. Which kind of reminded me about you talking about NVIDIA,
Yeah.
and I guess there was a new mobile architecture.
Yeah. So at CES the other week, they announced their new processor called, what is it, the Tegra, the K1. So what it is, it's an integrated chip that includes either quad core ARM processor, or what's kind of interesting, there are a couple of things that are interesting. One is the quad core ARM processor is kind of run of the mill. Not super exciting. The other one is that they have a dual core Denver. It's called Denver, which is kind of their in-house homebrewed architecture that actually goes back to, as far as we can kind of tell, it goes back to some old stuff at a company called Transmeta. Did you ever hear of Transmeta?
No.
So basically, the idea was that they were building RISC chips for like an x86 world. So what would happen is they had like super optimized instructions that were really complicated and everything, but they figured that humans didn't need to know about that. So they built a translation layer that would take standard x86 instructions and transmute them into this special operation set. So it would just do like a, it would just translate between it, and then they could get really low power and high performance. And it never quite delivered. They had like the Caruso core, I think it was called. It never quite delivered. But NVIDIA is bringing that, it looks like it's bringing that back. With the way that they're kind of describing the instruction set is interesting. So we don't have the full details. They haven't done a deep dive yet. They just kind of glossed over it. But that's what the opinion seems to be. So and Anon Tech has a really great article about it. But the other part of it is that they basically brought the mobile GPU up to using the same core as their current desktop processors and desktop cards.
Wow.
So obviously it's smaller, but basically what they did was they just scaled it down, cleaned it up, scaled it down. So it actually operates with the full API as the normal GPU, as the normal desktop GPUs. And also what they announced is that they are now a mobile first company. So each new generation of GPUs will premiere first on their mobile architecture, mobile chipsets.
Wow.
And then will get scaled up to run on the desktop.
Is that just because it's easy to engineer in that way? Or is it because mobile is the moneymaker now?
I think because mobile is the moneymaker. I mean, think about how many phones Samsung ships versus how many cards that NVIDIA sells in a year.
Yeah.
So I think it's partially that. It's also they have to do something to differentiate themselves in this space. Their Tegra processors their chipsets have just never been that impressive. And so now with K1, they've got not only the Denver core, which is interesting from a technical standpoint,
mm-hmm.
And also is definitely moving in the right direction, where they're realizing instead of four wimpy cores, we're just going to give you two big cores. And realizing that applications are actually better to scale to that, but also with this GPU. And the GPU supports the full CUDA 6 instruction set. So in reality, what you now have is an extremely powerful desktop-like architecture in the phone. Which, as I was looking at this, I was just kind of thinking, like, what on earth could you do with something like this? Think about the fact that now, especially with the API support, where I don't have to I can offload a bunch of my really computationally intense stuff, especially like using OpenCL, right? Using OpenCL, I can write my program, have all the heavy computation run like on a GPU or something like that. The barriers between me running that on my Mac and running it on my Android now are those barriers are shrinking.
What if we took over every cell phone in the world and turned it into a big cloud?
Are you talking about the NSA? I'm sorry. Turn it like what?
Like if every phone has this kind of a processor that's highly capable, then, and you know, we do have systems like, I think, there was the RNA Foldit game.
Yeah.
If you're familiar
with
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Foldit.
Yeah. So, you know, if we sort of took that kind of an approach to solve big problems, what if we kind of not just crowdsource but use people's phones as and connecting them together to make a big old cloud?
Yeah.
I think we have way more mobile devices than we do have computers.
Oh, hands down. I think I did that calculation once on the total megaflops of, theoretically, I looked at like IDC's sales reports or so, the number of devices they thought they estimated. I estimated the megaflops, and I can't remember what it was, but it was fairly significant.
The singularity, you're going to be one big cohesive
unit.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to, yeah. But anyways, so that's what I was thinking about. I was thinking about along the similar lines, right? So we had like Project Blink,
mm-hmm.
like these embarrassingly parallel problems that are really important and complicated, but work really well as being broken into tiny little atomic units and then processed. So what if we were able to distribute that to all these Android and iPhone devices, and they just in your pocket were just running as part of like helping to solve like science and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, and now you've got these like the Moto X or the iPhone 5S, which have these discrete motion coprocessors or these tiny little processors that just, they're always on, they're always running, they're really low power, and they do specific functions. Like, could you harness that together? It would be interesting to look at what is the minimum clock what's like the minimum clock speed that one core on these ARM chips can ratchet down to and still be running without generating a lot of heat or noticeably. Like, there's buckets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could we get it into that bucket and then just run this Blink process in the background? Yes, it would take 24 hours as opposed to an hour on your desktop. But still, you're not doing anything else. It's like a minimum power state that we can kind of slip these instructions into.
Mm-hmm.
Or at night when you plug it into charge, right? All you care about is that it's charged in the morning.
Right.
So my phone charges at, you know, 4 o'clock in the 4 a.m. it's done, right? It's charged mm-hmm. up. So why can't you just ratchet the power up and just run it there? You know,
right.
I set it on my desk, right? There's no heat issue, or the theoretically less heat issues. What can we do about that? And it just got me thinking that I wonder if we really understand what to do with the mobile space in terms of capability for computing or research or just or anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we just now have Google Now and like Siri, which actually use our data to help us achieve, you know, marginally useful things, right? What else could we do?
But I think we've come up on an hour now.
Yep.
So it's time for us to sign off. So thank you guys for listening to us. And you can follow me on Twitter. You can follow Nick on Twitter as well.
Yep.
Nick, do you have any closing thoughts?
I don't. Stay tuned next time for when we talk about all the things that have been piling up over the last couple weeks that we haven't gotten to because we've talked about all the other exciting things that we have. So thank you guys for listening. Again, please send us your feedback with any topics you'd like us to discuss, things to steer away from. And, yeah, any other thoughts that you might have? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, guys.